Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. This talk and the talk tomorrow are intended to be inspirational rather than informational. They may not have many hard facts, or I may not be talking about doctrine per se. And you will have to grant me a little poetic license to use words and images to convey what I'm hoping to. And knowing that sometimes, or not knowing exactly where a talk may end up, for those who may be listening to it at a later date, I'm assuming a certain familiarity with the practice of serene reflection meditation, Soto Zen meditation. If I'm lucky, I may be able to stir something within you that you, that we all know already. Like a song heard in the womb a long time ago and all but forgotten. And many years later, when you think you hear it for the first time, there's just something about it. But this will probably be true, more true for the second talk than this first talk. To some extent, the first talk is an introduction or part one, and the second talk is the part two. The image of today's talk is that of a bird in a cage. A bird longing to be free, longing to be in the blue sky it sees above itself and through the bars of its cage. All that has brought this bird into being are from the deep past, matter, nature, conditioning, compels it to look to the sky for its freedom. And so repeatedly it tries to reach the sky, going directly for its goal, only to be stopped by the cage, to which it clings until it tries again in vain. Its error is not so much in imagining where its freedom lies. There is truth in that, but its error is more in the method by which it can find its freedom. Because of its constant gaze skyward, it misses the true nature of its cage. For this cage is without a bottom, and the bird's freedom can be achieved in an instant should the bird simply let go and stop all effort and fall to and through the non-existent bottom. But that would require going against the forces acting upon it, which are very strong and deep, and so it remains trapped. I can remember it being somewhat sobering to hear, after this analogy or image came to mind, that there are in fact traps built to catch birds that utilize this property. Farmers use them to trap birds which would otherwise peck out the eyes of their sheep, for example, of the lambs, and debilitate them. Then they'd eventually die. But to know that a creature would actually fail to save its life by following its instincts made the analogy a little more real. The state of this bird in the cage is essentially the state of humanity when it comes to seeking religious truth and religious freedom. As Reverend Master Jia used to say, someone came up with the term enlightenment and we've been stuck with it ever since. The Buddha never once used the term enlightenment. That's our term. Did he ever use an equivalent term? I don't know. However, I'm sure whatever words he used were not intended to raise the sorts of misconceptions and misdirections of energy that the term enlightenment raises. In some respects, one is better off never hearing of the concepts of enlightenment or nirvana. Because, as I said, they raise preconceptions. And what is preconceived is sought after like any other thing we think we lack. We use the same method. The person who is dragged along to learn how to meditate by someone else who's keen to learn how to meditate and find a preconceived state often does better than the two and can unexpectedly have a profound experience because their mind is not entangled with expectations and greeds. However, once one has preconceptions, which we all do, with mindfulness, they can be used positively. They can bring us to our cushion, but then they have to be let go of, along with everything else, along with the idea of a you, the idea of religion, the idea of meditation, along with one's idea of reality itself, or that one even needs any sort of reality to be able to function. However, as I said, we are like the bird in the cage. Our capacity to know is both our greatest treasure and the source of our imprisonment. Enlightenment, nirvana, freedom, peace. We all want to know these things, and we want to know that we know them. But approaching the truth as if it is an object to be apprehended by the intellect will ultimately lead to disappointment. Even if there is some sense of accomplishment found through the intellect, such progress will be subjective and will eventually lead to a point beyond which one cannot pass. A bird may move closer to the sky by flying to the top of its cage and in one sense come closer to its goal. But in fact, it is fooled by the false promise of a method which will never bring final success. For us, the trick is to utilize the intellect in a way that helps and is appropriate. It needn't be rejected, just its limitations need to be recognized and accepted. However, its usefulness is so ingrained in us that it is hard not to rely on it, especially when it provides us with occasional satisfaction. Clinging to the occasional satisfaction, they and the method which brought them about become the bars of our cage. And sometimes even within our cage, we revel in the freedom we have to be here in the cage. Now we are free to go over here in the cage. So dexterous are we. How free we seem to be. But clearly, we're not free. Even religion can be a bar of our cage. A lovely golden bar, but one in which it is easy to see the gold and hard to see that it's the bar of a cage. Some in the cage may simply make an attractive little nest of ideas and beliefs, which all fit together, and they settle in, content. Are they the lucky ones, or are they not? This, I think, is one of the meanings of enlightened within delusion. Where there is a certain contentment, peace, but it's easy to get stuck there. And it's a contentment and peace which lasts as long as everything stays in place, as long as life doesn't start yanking out pieces of the nest, because then it starts to fall apart. It's probably better to be deluded within delusion, because you're less likely to be stuck. You know there's something wrong or there's something more. Deluded within enlightenment is a little further along. If somehow one manages to get outside of the cage, but it's clinging to the cage on the outside, saying, I'm free, I'm free, and dragging the cage around to show yourself and everyone else what you're free from. And this typically happens when someone has a genuine understanding. Especially an initial understanding, because although a true part of oneself, one's mind, one's discriminatory mind has been converted, it's usually partial, and the discriminatory mind, what remains of the self, looks at the part that's been chinked off and says, wow, look at that, that's mine. And that's normal. But hopefully, over time, one gets the sense that that's not working, and one has more and more chunks broken off that are converted, and eventually there's enough there that one gets the point, that one doesn't cling to anything. And enlightened within enlightenment is something of a misnomer, what you have to, because enlightenment doesn't exist at that point. Another example of deluded within enlightenment is exemplified by the mind of a prisoner who is in prison for 20 years for something he or she didn't do. And he or she longs to be free. And one day the warden comes down and opens the front gate and says, we know you're innocent. And they step out free into the archway of the prison. And they just feel the joy and the rush and the exhilaration of being free. And they go into the world and things become normal, boring, maybe even hard. And they say, well, what's gone wrong here? And they go back and say, I want to feel like I did. So they go back and stand in the archway of the prison where they felt that and try to feel it. But freedom is not the feeling of freedom. It's much deeper than that. And we mistake what is not the important thing for the important thing if we live in our feelings and in our thoughts and opinions. And we can turn them into bars. Effectively, he's back in another sort of prison, a prison of wanting a particular feeling. But the fact that each one of you, by your own choice, is now sitting in front of a wall or in front of a screen indicates that you are probably not content to be a bird in the nest in a cage. But the way out of our cage is not an easy one, or perhaps I should say it is easy to see the way, but hard to walk it. For like the bird, the forces acting on us are ancient and deeply embedded. They are hard to counteract. It is hard to counteract. The force of old habits and the flow of worldliness that exists within us and around us. To me, this effort of not going along with these forces acting upon us is the symbolic meaning of that part of the story of the Buddha. When prior to his enlightenment, he places his begging bowl, which traditionally symbolizes the mind, into a nearby river, and it floats upstream against the force of the river. It symbolizes his commitment to not be carried away. But as I said, to do this within ourselves, with our own minds, is easy in one sense and difficult in another. Meditation is easy to understand. In fact, because there is nothing that we do in meditation, there is nothing to understand as to how to do it. So there's nothing to get wrong in one sense in terms of understanding. All we do is let go of doing. The difficulty comes in first accepting that it's really that simple, and then in the keeping up of the letting go of doing, of deliberate self-effort, and of not getting swept away. But if we do keep at it, by accident, we may find ourselves out of the cage. How this happens, how this really happens, is at least to me a mystery, or at least it has elements of it that just remain mysterious. And I can't really tell you anything other than just keep returning to the mind of meditation. Meditating for no purpose and for no goal. And if you have faith in this naive process, your efforts will be confirmed and reconfirmed. Don't think of fast or slow. Don't compare yourself to others. Just meditate. And forget about the fact that you're meditating when you do so. The nature of being outside of the cage cannot be imagined beforehand. Nonetheless, tomorrow I will try to say some things about it as best I can, with the hope that it will inspire you to continue with your practice. The scriptures say, all fully seem and dull, this naive practice of just sitting, letting go of the known, and looking at the wall. But doing so is active faith. All acceptance is the key to the gateless gate, as it has been called, then all acceptance means accepting all. It's accepting what appears to you to be the state of unknowing. True faith accepts things exactly as they are, accepts the creation exactly like it is, without judging it, without thinking, I should be in another state of mind, and I reject the state of mind that I'm in. If we let go of rejecting or grasping, then we allow the potential for the perfection that exists within us to be seen. But again, it's more a matter of accident than precise science. So, try to recognize when you're the bird and sensing when you're trying to find something through thinking, through the intellect, through discrimination that essentially can't be found that way. Just return to simply sitting, simply letting go. And don't worry if it seems like it will not produce anything. Although don't sit there and think, if I do this, this is what will produce things. Just have to let go of the whole lot. And the truth will appear naturally. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. This talk today assumes, as did the talk yesterday, that one has a familiarity with serene reflection meditation, Soto Zen meditation. And I caution you to avoid trying to dissect intellectually what I might be saying. But grant me a certain amount of poetic license. Anything I may mention, above all, is not intended to be scientific, but it is an offering with the hope that you will get a sense of something behind the words. So simply listen even better, just hear. Just let the faculty of your hearing do its job without you interpreting or filtering. I can remember in this regard going to an art museum and not fancying myself a particular appreciator of modern art. I decided just not to think about it, rather than decide whether I liked something or not, or whether I understood it or not. So I just stood in front of the paintings, or walked through the modern art exhibitions, and found it a very refreshing, completely different experience. I'd like you to let your minds slip back to before your life, back in time, before all human life, before the stars, beyond the imaginable past, before the existence of time or the appearance of space itself. A place before any characteristics. A place of infinite, eternal repose. Without lack, without accomplishment. The very womb of unborn time and space. A place of absolute unknowing. A place unknown to itself. One can imagine that in such a place it might take forever for something to happen. However, having no time and eternity of forevers passes no different than an instant. And there appears out of the unknowing a characteristic, a first aspect, which we might imagine as a light, streaking across the vastness of something strange and new, space. Brought into existence simultaneously by the appearance of the first aspect, and by the first aspect being contrasted against that which it is not. And with the appearance of the first aspect was the beginning of its existence, which endured and brought forth the existence of time. Thus, with the appearance of the first aspect, were born both time and space. And with the stage set, the game was on, and the journey begun. Started at the beginning of time and space, and at the edge of time and space. A journey of that which is, or as we might imagine, the journey of a being. You could say it is your journey, my journey, but the you and the I as we know them, will come much later. And so this being travels, and travels, and travels, and travels, and travels, and I can continue the rest of my life traveling on in this way. And the magnitude of what I would have accomplished compared to the magnitude of the journey would be as a drop of water is to all the oceans of the world. But eventually, the universe of time and space is traversed. And zot! Here you are now, a human being, a human mind, looking at a wall, looking at a meditation screen. The journey completed, save for one last step. However, that last step is not one of traveling. It's not one that is a matter of distance, but a matter of mind. A matter of waking up, of shaking off the artifacts of the journey. Although they are both open, eyes open in a dream do not see what I see when awake. Open, awake eyes complete the arrival. Do you know the one who looks out from behind your eyes? The seeing of this one is not your looking. Pure seeing is without desire, without seeing, without a seer, without an object seen. Like a camera placed on a shelf, peering out the opposite wall. Content to see what it sees for 1,000 years, without rejection, without grasping, utterly desireless. It is the operator that takes the faculty of seeing of the camera and uses it. With the judgmental mind, with the mind that seeks and rejects. But seeing is fundamentally desireless. Looking is using the faculty of sight to hunt. Hearing and listening are like this. Hearing does not pick and choose. Listening searches. The seeing and hearing of the true one within you is your true eternal seeing and hearing. And yet we do not know this one, or true seeing or hearing. To know this one, we must become like this one. And our looking and our listening have to be relinquished. but with vows of gratitude, for without our looking and our listening, there would have been no crossing of the vast sea of the opposites. To deliver this true one here and now, carried like an unseen treasure. Your work is done. The jewel is on the altar. The scriptures say, forsaking self, the universe grows I. Forsaking means not claiming seeing as your own, not claiming hearing as your hearing. Do not worry that it will be ownerless. Seeing, hearing, thinking can function without your assistance. Lay down the burden. Let seeing see. Let hearing hear. Let thinking think. When you walk, just walk. But do not take control of thinking to create concepts of seeing seeing, hearing hearing, or thinking thinking. Just gently relinquish all that arises and let the Buddha do all. And if you do, you will over time be transformed. And you may, from time to time, witness your own transformation. Do not grab on to what you witness. Do not claim anything for your own. The nature of transformation is that you become more and more living emptiness. Do not turn your understanding into anything. In its own time and in its own way, that within you will be consummated. Whether it be gradual or abrupt, you will forget all. The mind rendered thoughtless, still, as if by a cosmic shock. Being as if dead, you will have gratefully attained the release of the dead. Yet seeing will see, the hand will raise, and thoughts will arise. Moving time will vanish. The present moment will remain eternal. Whereas before, time was like the sliding window of a slide rule, which moved along one event after the other, becoming one thing, then another. Good times, bad times. Now the lens will be still. In the moment, and the ruler moves. Appearances move through the eternal now. The moment is changeless. Our so-called time is the time of Shakyamuni Buddha, the time of the dinosaurs, the time of the formation of the heavens. It is the time of the moment of the appearance of the first aspect. in its absolute stillness, it is indeed the very womb of time and space, here and now. The beginning and the end are one. In fact, we have never left the womb of time and space, the womb of the Tathagata. But it took, if you like, a great journey of imagination to realize it. This eternal moment is unproduced by any cause. It is not produced by our efforts, any more than silence is created when the sound ceases. Silence is eternally present, but it takes the stopping of the noise to reveal it. Once you truly know it, it always exists, undiminished, simultaneously with the existence of sound. And with the underlying nature of one's mind revealed, one's home is in the aspectless. Without lack, without accomplishment. Nothing to do. Undisturbed by the world of appearances and multiplicity moving through it. Like a mirror, fundamentally unaffected by that which appears in it. Realizing the dual nature of humanity, one is stationed simultaneously in the timeless and that which pertains to time. The self is still there, but the Lord of the house is the Lord of the house. And this is your house, your home. The world of discriminating thinking, of the opposites, is no longer your home. You only visit there when asked, and let it go when the moment is over. Enlightenment, delusion, even the Lord of the house forgotten. There is neither coming nor going, nor anything clung to which could come or go. There is just sweeping the floor, although there is no dust, and the ceaseless activity of goalless training within the world of appearances. Nothing special. No longer driven by the seeking implicit in the first cause which streaked across newborn space. Just the simple ongoing meditation of the Buddhas and ancestors. For no purpose whatsoever, except perhaps to keep it that way. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.